You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a talk by historian Howard Zinn on the myth of the Cold War.
At one point, Thomas Friedman, who is not exactly a radical critic of American foreign policy, writes for the New York Times at that point, and he says, we may be going to war over the price of gasoline. You know, occasionally those guys on that side say something sort of honest and true, and when they do, you have to pay attention to it. So it continues, the interventions, and all with humanitarian pretenses. And so we have to, if it's not communism, then we have to look for the reasons. And the reasons become, as soon as you put aside pretense of that we're fighting against communism, we're fighting for humanitarian reasons, we're fighting for democracy, we're fighting for self-determination, as soon as you sort of cut through all of that, what are you left with? You're left with sort of old-time reasons, which are still true. Profit, money, oil, tin, rubber, sugar, profit, military contracts, and political power. I mean, it's not simply economic. There are other factors, too. There are the things that drive presidential decisions very often, even if the presidents haven't thought through the economics of it. If you look at the tapes of LBJ, recently released, or tapes of John F. Kennedy recently released about the Vietnam War, you're startled. Because what you see is that Johnson is deciding whether we should plunge into this bloody war in Vietnam. And he knows it's going to be bloody. And he's making a decision based on his political fortunes. Because he's saying, well, he says, yes. And his friend Richard Russell, not exactly a liberal progressive, Richard Russell of Georgia, is saying, but Russell is sort of looking and says, why would we go into Vietnam? Why do we? Because Russell hasn't talked recently to the oil and tin and rubber interests, but he's asking this question, and John is saying, I know, it's too, people will die and so on. But then he says, if I don't, I might be impeached, mightn't I? You mean you're willing to go to war and shed all this blood to prevent your impeachment, your political fortunes? And the answer is yes. I mean, it's hard for American citizens brought up the way we are and having a kind of naive belief in our political leaders to think that they would be willing to sacrifice the lives of huge numbers of people for political gain. But leaders all over the world do that. I mean, what I'm saying about the United States is true of imperial powers all through history, imperial powers everywhere. The United States is not unique in all of these things that have been done to other countries. All the other empires have done that to other places. Just the United States comes last upon the world scene and is the biggest and most powerful and does the most, you see. Kennedy, contemplating in 1963 the possible withdrawal of American troops from Vietnam, but saying, I think we ought to wait until the election. Really? Really? You look at the Kennedy tapes. The election. I mean, that's how you're going to decide whether we should have troops in Vietnam or not troops in Vietnam, get involved in Vietnam or not get involved in Vietnam, depending on the election? And you get, this is a continuous thread. If you look at Bush on the eve of the Gulf War and Bush's aide, Sununu, do you remember him? He's sort of, hard to forget that name. Sununu. And he's saying, we need something to happen. We need something to boost the political fortunes of Bush. I'm not you know, I'm, as you can see, paraphrasing, but it's very much something like that. So, yes, there's economic interest in this, and there's politics, and there's a military-industrial complex, and all of that. And it continues, and no more communism, but we have to get down to the bare essentials and realize that ultimately it's a class phenomenon. Ultimately, it's the profits of the rich in the world versus the lives and the fortunes of the poor people in the world. Yes, in the United States, but the poor people and the victims all over the world. And so that gives us an enormous responsibility. That gives all of us an enormous responsibility to do what we can to resist this, to organize against this, to reject the two parties that represent this, no matter what, remember, all the terrible things we've done to other people in the world have been bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans. You know, whatever difference you can find between Gore and Bush on this or that, and yes, you can find differences. There's also the fact that on the matter of war and militarism and military budgets, the Democratic and Republicans have been united in all of these things and remain united and are proud that they are united. So we have a responsibility to build a movement in this country to resist militarism and to insist that the enormous wealth of this country, which has been used to profit the war contractors and to do bad things in the world, that huge sum of money, plus more huge sums of money to come out of just taxation of the super rich in this country, that all that wealth of this country should be used for the things that people need, for universal health care, for schools, for child care, for housing for everybody, to do the things that are fundamentally decent things to do when a country is as rich as ours. So, yeah, we have a lot of work to do. And it's a good idea to get involved, whether it's with Food Not Bombs or any one of the other 100 organizations that send me mail every day. And, you know, whatever it is that appeals to you, but somebody, get together with other people who are doing good things and you know, people that you like and people who sing songs and tell jokes and go to the movies. But get together with such people and, you know, when enough of such get-togethers take place all over this country, you know, we will have, even though you can't see it at this point, even though you don't know what will happen, but that's how great movements become alive out of the little things that people do. And you have to do those little things that you do with a kind of hope and faith that at some point it will coalesce with little things that a million other people do. And as a result, we might have a better society and a better world. Thank you. There's a question period. You don't have to stay for the question period, although most of you are so hemmed in that there's no point trying to escape. Yes. Yeah, the Illuminati. You asked about the Illuminati, which is the name given to a group of very, very powerful people, right, who are getting together and who are making decisions about what will happen to the world. I mean, there have been various manifestations of the Illuminati, you know, over time. You know, after World War II, there was the Trilateral Commission in which, after World War II, you know, the United States and countries in Western Europe and Japan and some important people government people, corporation people, some important journalists, you know, powerful people got together in a trilateral commission, and they said, now let's look at the world and where it is now. They did this after the Vietnam War, and they said, what do we do now? And where do we go, and what is our strategy, and so on. And so there's, as you say, the Illuminati. Who, you know, you're referring to a specific book?
Several books.
A number of books written. And I mean, all I can say, I don't have inside information about these people. But and I don't even believe it, you know, I don't believe it's necessary for like a finite group of people to get together in a room and to plan all the terrible things that go on in the world, because these terrible things are driven by what they call market forces. It's the wonderful thing about the so-called free market, that all you have to do is have a system in which profit drives policy, and if money, profit drives policy, then there will be a natural selection of events which will move everything towards disaster, you see, really. And so, but from time to time, yes, important people do get together and they talk with one another and they try to figure out, you know, what to do and how to deal with threats. You know, I don't doubt that after Seattle, you know, there were conferences that took place. And you would think, well, what? They don't have to do this, do they? They're so powerful. And we're so, you know, small. But the fact is that powerful people worry. They worry that small movements will become big movements. I mean, that's why the FBI did all. That's why the FBI did ridiculous things, going after people who had very little power, because they are paranoid. You know, although actually it's not paranoia. I take that back. They are realistic. They know that small movements become big movements. They know that one person on a picket line could become 10 and 100 and 1,000 and a huge demo. They know that, you know. So, but I figure we can't, you know, concentrate on what they're doing and thinking. We know what, you know, what they're up to. And our job is to work for the things we believe in. You know, food, not bombs, and women's rights, and racial equality, and, you know, the rights of gays and lesbians, and and of disabled people, and of children, and to work on all of these things, and cause them more worry. Not spend our time penetrating, you know, their inner circles, but creating our own enormous circles, which will then finally make their inner circle impotent. What kind of organizing gives me the most hope these days? I think it's the kind of organizing that unites various groups around what I think may be the central issue for this next period in American history. There's a kind of organizing that took place in Seattle, in Washington, and in Prague, and which is international in scope, and which is based on an alliance among many, many different groups who have different agendas, whether it's feminism or environmentalism, or, you know, decent wage for low-paid people, health and care, and so on. What unites all of these people is the fact that none of these things are obtainable, none of the things that people need are obtainable unless we have a massive change in the way the resources of the society are distributed, you know, and the economic system, you know. And so any kind of organizing that is aimed at that very fundamental thing, that kind of radical thing, redistribution of wealth, tearing away more and more at the system that is based on corporate profit, and trying to build a society more and more based on human need. That kind of multi-group and international organizing, it seems to me, is the most important. Advice to somebody who's going to be a history teacher. Advice for somebody who's going to be a history teacher. Find friends. Find allies. Or you're going into a snake pit. If you go into an institution, you go into a university, you go into the academic world, or you go into a school system, you're going to face bureaucrats, and you're going to face narrow-minded department heads and colleagues who look askance at anybody who moves outside the parameters of the textbook, you see. You're going to face all of that. So you're going to be a minority, and so you're going to have to fight, and you shouldn't have to fight alone. That's why I say look for friends. And the friends you'll find among maybe a few colleagues, but the greatest friends you'll find is among students. And the student-faculty alliances are very, very important. And you know, there have been times when faculty have run into great, great difficulty with administrations which decided those faculty should be gotten rid of. And when students organized, they were able to keep the faculty and the institution. So, yeah. And I guess the other thing is teach the way you want to. Don't be intimidated into teaching what they want you to teach. It's very easy to be intimidated, very easy to be a history teacher who goes to radical rallies and this and that, but who in the classroom follows, you know, the curriculum you're given and the textbooks that you're given. You know, you don't have to burn the textbooks that you're given, but you can supplement them with good stuff, you see. And, you know, it's a kind of, when you're a teacher in this system, you play a kind of guerrilla warfare with the system. And the reward is the reactions of your students. And you're feeling better about yourself than if you just follow the rules. Yes. Well, this woman has asked about the situation in Colombia. You know, the $1.456 billion the United States is giving to Colombia, mostly in military aid, presumably to fight the drug war, but indeed basically to keep the present government of Colombia in power and to fight the guerrilla movement in Colombia, which is based on the poverty of the Colombian people. So I know you know, very often when people ask you questions like that, it's because they know the answers, but, right? What's that? The real reason why the United States is doing what it's doing? Well, I think basically the same reason why the United States has intervened again and again in other countries and given military aid to other countries. It's to prevent, we don't want another Castro in Colombia. We don't want another Sandinista government in Colombia. We don't want a revolutionary movement to succeed in Colombia, which might not become a satellite of the United States. We want to maintain American influence in Colombia, and we will support whatever regime, however repressive that regime is, and this Colombian government has been repressive, we will support any kind of repressive regime and keep it in power because then it will play ball with American corporations and with the American political leadership. I think that's the reason. The question is that is there a positive role that the United States could play in this conflict in the Middle East? Are the media portraying the United States as the peacekeepers and right, we're the, you know, we will mediate and so on and so forth? Well, it's sort of, for the United States to mediate the conflict between the Israeli government and the Palestinians is a very odd kind of situation. I mean, we've been brought into it because we're so powerful and because we insist on being the mediator. But, of course, the United States has been allied to Israel. It hasn't been allied to the Palestinian movement. It's been allied to Israel and has been giving Israel huge amounts of military and economic aid over the years. And so to expect the United States to mediate And this successfully in this situation doesn't really make any sense. And in fact, it hasn't worked. Whatever the United States comes up with will be suspect in the Palestinian world. And the most constructive thing that the United States can do is to decide something that's very hard for the Israeli government to decide, because the Israeli government is beset by the extremists in Israel, you see. But the United States, not beset by those extremists, there's a pro-Israeli lobby in the United States and so on, but it's not as serious. It can be dealt with. What the United States should be doing is taking a hard look at the situation. Now I'm talking about something utopian, because the United States is not going to do this. But you ask, what could the United States? The United States should, as I say, could say what the Israeli government cannot say. The Israelis have been occupying Palestinian territory. At the end of World War II, they took what was 100% Palestinian land, and they insist on taking the 20% that they won by military victory in 1967, and occupying it, or finally, after an intifada and after all so much resistance, the United States is willing to say, the United States is willing to go along, we'll withdraw from part of, or even most of, the occupied territories, we are not going to say that this territory belongs to the Palestinians because it's Palestinian territory. It's as if after the American Revolution, the British said, we'll get out of 11 of the colonies, but not out of 11 of the states, but we insist on maintaining troops in 2 of the 13 states. And it's a very simple matter. Very simple matter of justice that the Palestinians, having been driven out of the rest of Israel after 1948, deserve to have that territory, that 20% that was taken by force in the 1967 war, and where the vast majority of the people living there are Palestinians. They deserve to have Israel military force out of there. And that's so the United States should be saying that and saying to Israel, if you don't do that, you're not going to get our military aid anymore. Now, Israel, that's talking very tough to Israel. That's talking very tough to Israel, But if there is any role for the United States, that's the only role I can see it playing. You ask, are there any situations which would justify military intervention? No. I can't think of any situations that would justify military intervention. No. Because I can think of situations that justify intervention, but not military intervention. I can think of situations that justify the sending of peacekeeping forces, the sending of forces that might, for instance, that might have, and it would have taken very little in Rwanda, perhaps, to stop the slaughter at the time. It didn't take a military intervention, but it took some sort of intervention, a very small-scale peacekeeping intervention to prevent the massacres that went on. And I think intervening is possible, and it's justified to intervene in other countries non-militarily for the purpose of preventing terrible things that are going on and of keeping the peace. But there is something inherently dangerous and wrong and immoral about military interventions. Because if you look at the history of military intervention since World War II, those military interventions always turn out to be disastrous. It never turns out that we help the people we claim we are helping by these interventions. And so Well, for a very simple reason. The people who engage in these military interventions, their aim is not a humanitarian one. That's why we didn't intervene in any way in Rwanda. You know, there's no problem. There's no oil there, and so on. There's I'm opposed to military intervention. I'm opposed to war. Period. And we have to decide war, military intervention, military solutions never work. They may seem to work in the short run, but in the long run, they're disastrous. Sometimes they're in the short run, they're disastrous too. But no, we have to, it's not a matter of being isolationist in the world. It's a matter of intervening without military force in every possible way we can to help bring about just solutions to problems in the world. Yeah. She's asking me, the people who are well off and educated and so on, what can they do? And then she says, but, you know, I don't really expect you to know the answer to that question. And you're right. I don't know the answer to that question. Well, no, I'm joking, of course. what can we do? We do what everybody else does. The fact that we may be well off and educated should not get in the way of whatever we want to do. We should join with people who are not so well off, who are not so well educated, but who may be more intelligent, and join with all these people in the movements for social change. That's all I can say. There's time for one more question, because 9 o'clock is the deadline. Who is the most eager? Who is... Yes, what can I say to people who are enthusiastic for Nader, but who are fearful of George Bush, and thinking about the Supreme Court and Supreme Court appointments? And, well, it may be, you know, it may be true, and it's not certain, you know, that the appointments of the Supreme Court will be radically different, whether Bush is in or Gore is in, because ultimately the Senate has to approve these appointments. What's that?
That's right.
I didn't hear. Oh, she said amen? Is that what she said? Oh, this is, I forgot, that's a church. That's what people say here. I see, okay. But you know, I wouldn't claim, you know, there's absolutely no difference between Gore and Bush, although sometimes the difference is not to the advantage of Gore. I mean, it might be that on, and I don't know this, and you never notice in advance, that you know, Bush seems more cautious about military intervention than Gore, although you never know in a situation whose, both of them are really interventionists. Both of them are for a big military budget. And I guess what I'm saying is that whatever differences, marginal, and they're marginal differences you can find, maybe the Supreme Court, maybe not. As I said, the Supreme Court requires both Republicans and Democrats to agree before a Supreme Court justice is nominated. And, Scalia, the worst member of the Supreme Court, was unanimously voted for by every Democrat in the Senate, including Gore and Lieberman. And so, you know, to predicate your voting for Gore on the basis of, well, it will make a big difference in the Supreme Court, I'm dubious. Say another thing about the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court decides is not so much based on who are the members of the Supreme Court sitting on the court at this time, but in the long run based on what is happening in the country. And what kind of movements do you have in the country? And if you have a great women's movement in the country, Roe v. Wade is not going to be overturned. I really believe that. You know, and as for other differences in, you know, other differences are marginal. Both of them want to take huge chunks of the presumed surplus and pay off the bondholders, really. when that money could, both of them, except, you know, Bush wants to pay more of it to the bondholders than Gore. But that's like, you know, that's the difference, you know. You know, Bush asks from his financial donors who want to attend dinner with him, he asks $400,000 a head. Gore asks $300,000 a head. You know, and, you know, those are the differences between them. On foreign policy, it's very hard to find a difference. They're both for landmines. And they're, you know, they're both for a huge military budget. They're both for, you know, maintaining troops wherever we have troops. And domestic, they're both for the death penalty. You know, they both support of the devastation Clinton did to poor families when he signed the so-called welfare reform. They're both in favor of building more prisons, as in the crime bill that was passed during the Clinton administration. And I'm not willing to surrender my conscience, you see, for that, you know, for that, you know. To put it another way, to vote for somebody who might be a slightly lesser evil every 4 years means you will always be stuck with evil, you see, always, you see. You know, it's not a matter of a short term who's in the White House. It's a matter of a long term. How do we build a new political movement, a new independent political movement? So, anyway, thank you.
That was Professor Howard Zinn speaking last fall in Boston on the myth of the Cold War. Howard Zinn will be speaking in Ithaca at Cornell University on Thursday, April 12th. At 8 p.m. in Bailey Hall. He will speak on Is Democracy Possible? The event is free and open to the public. Tickets will be available after the 1st of April at the ticket office in Willard Strait on the Cornell campus and in downtown Ithaca on the Commons at Autumn Leaves Used Books. There will be a reception after the event where audience members will be able to talk with student and community groups, and there will be free food. Next, we'll take a look at the results of the policy Zinn has discussed on the country of Ecuador. Sue Supriano interviewed Carwell James of Project Underground about the fight of the Ecuadorian people against the multinational forces that are looting their resources and destroying their environment. Carwell James begins by explaining what his organization does.
Project Underground is a human rights organization based in Berkeley. There are 12 of us, and we work together to support the human rights of communities resisting the mining and oil industries. And we do that by providing information to those communities, to people in resistance, and also by taking on particular campaigns. On the oil side, we are currently supporting the Uwa people and their resistance against Occidental Petroleum from drilling on their sacred homeland in northeastern Colombia, and working together with peoples of the Niger Delta who are confronting Chevron, which is a hometown company for us. Chevron has been involved in structural and institutional racism and environmental damage and human rights abuses within the Niger Delta. We also work on mining campaigns around Newmont Gold Mining Corporation, which is the United States' largest gold mining corporation, and also in a neighbor to Ecuador. We're working to support the Rondas Campesinas, who are opposing the Yanacocha gold mine, which has produced all kinds of mercury spills, water degradation, and a variety of pollution effects for them for many years.
Mm-hmm. Right now, what's happening this week as we speak, which is the beginning of February or February 9th, so the Ecuadorian colonial regime has started killing the indigenous people of Ecuador in an effort to enforce IMF, International Monetary Fund, mandated policies, which are casting the people of Ecuador into extreme poverty and destroying their environment in order to satisfy the insatiable profit requirements of multinational corporations, as well as making Ecuador available as a base for U.S. military intervention in South America. So, but fill in the details, Carwell.
Sure. Well, what we saw this week, really starting somewhat last week, but really kicking in on Saturday, was that the Ecuadorian government decided that the way to respond to a national indigenous uprising, a national indigenous and peasant uprising.
And I'm going to interrupt you and say that Ecuador, I think, has the biggest percentage of indigenous people living traditionally anywhere in South America. It's way over 50%, I think, but continue. Yep.
So indigenous peoples who make up a very large percentage of Ecuador, and also campesinos, including a lot of Afro-Ecuadorians, took part in a national uprising. And that is really the culmination of about a decade of really hard, consistent organizing by the indigenous peoples, who have felt both from economic policies and from the corporate and government colonization of indigenous lands, particularly in eastern Ecuador, in the Oriente region, the part that is part of the Amazon rainforest. They've seen a systematic effort with oil companies like Texaco and like Arco coming in at the same time as the government comes in, and it's an assault on their environment and on their culture. And when indigenous folks and poor folks all across Ecuador have rose up, have resisted, they faced human rights abuses. And so this was a concerted uprising to demand a new model for the way that Ecuador would be governed, and one that was not one that was dictated by the International Monetary Fund, which has put some very harsh conditions onto Ecuador. And in that, they were joined by a variety of other social movements. They were joined by the National Women's Movement. They were joined by environmentalists. They were joined by human rights supporters all across the country. And they were joined by the unions, who engaged in a national strike this past Wednesday in support of the indigenous uprising. So all across the political spectrum in Ecuador, all of the major sectors that represent, you know, these fundamental aspects of humanity really rose up in a concerted way together and challenged the Ecuadorian government and the IMF and U.S.-backed policies that it's been carrying out. And what we saw this week was a brief, fortunately, attempt by the government to put down this uprising, to say that, to really take on their people as a whole, using guns, using sticks, and using detention. On Saturday, there was a declaration of emergency by the Ecuadorian government, which empowered the military and the police to go throughout the country to use whatever force they deemed necessary against the protests, and also stripped Ecuadorians of their fundamental rights to freedom of association, to freedom of speech, to freedom from arbitrary search and seizure, and from freedom from arbitrary detention. And hundreds of people were detained. Tens of them were injured by gunshots, and four people died as a consequence of that wave of repression. And it was met by escalating resistance, more and more solidarity, and a lot of international solidarity, people from outside really calling on the Ecuadorian government to respect the rights of its people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take an opportunity to read just a little of what one of the delegations of protesters in Ecuador said about the International Monetary Fund, because it's an extremely important part of these protests, is that Ecuador has been under pressure to raise the prices of basic necessities, to cut off to cut off access to basic services, and to really use policies that put the burden of Ecuador's massive debt onto the poor people of Ecuador, who have never benefited from any of the loans that have come to them.
Okay, before you do that, I want to say something, because I was there a couple of years ago, and actually there was a general strike in the whole country. I was totally astounded at this. The gasoline prices got raised about four times, something like that, of what they had been. And, of course, we're talking about Ecuador being an oil-producing country. And, of course, most people are poor. I say of course because it's so often the way. And this would really, needless to say, influence everything, these high gas prices. And people went immediately, were on the roads, blocking the roads. It was very different than the United States. I was very amazed at how quickly people went into action and the kind of pride and the kind of courage they had to stand up against the government. I was quite happily flabbergasted, and I was in Quito some of the time, the main city, and I was very impressed by the degree of relaxation of the military and the police. It was very different than in this country. And so I don't know exactly what the IMF has done, but I'm sure they must really, really be squeezing the country to come to this, because I can personally testify that this is a big change from a couple of years ago, which I'm not saying was a piece of cake, and the government did back down, but it was only for a minute because the pressures on them are so strong.
Yeah, so what went on this time, and what's gone on, I mean, the big factors in Ecuador's economy in the past couple of years have been a new wave of IMF policies, and especially around the dollarization of the economy, so that all of Ecuador is being converted from a national Ecuadorian currency to a currency that's run for a country that is much larger, much more prosperous, and just with a lot more access to capital than it is. And that means that Ecuador's poor have to face the same kind of prices and the same kind of economic squeeze that people in the United States do, but obviously with far fewer dollars in their pockets. And part of that, part of the IMF-sponsored proposals were a doubling of fuel prices overnight, a 75% increase in transit prices all across the country. So a lot of people don't rely on transit fuel. They rely on fuel to put warm food on their tables, and they rely on the public transit system to get them where they need to go. And they were suddenly seeing themselves being completely denied regular access to that. And so that's been a squeeze that's been going on for months now, and it's a squeeze that in which there's been a lot of organizing. There was a similar uprising about a year ago, which actually resulted in the brief toppling of the Ecuadorian government. And for a while, there was, for just about 24 hours, actually, there was a provisional government which included indigenous representation in a three-person government that came out of the social movements. It had someone from the military, which is often has really, like, because it's conscripted members of the poor, who are the vast majority of Ecuador, and because it's had a sense of some sense of obligation, some sense of being in the community, and it derives its legitimacy from everyone going along with what it does, they and the Ecuador's indigenous people and Ecuador's unions came together and had this three-part government that lasted for 24 hours until the U.S. said, we have no interest in recognizing it. We're going to block any loans, any aid, any international credit to it. And so it was, you know, they stepped down and they were replaced immediately by the former vice president, who went on to carry out the same kind of policies that had led to the revolt in the first place.
And that was mostly because of the United States government.
It was United States pressure. And certainly the United States has been the arbiter of legitimacy throughout throughout the hemisphere, giving its blessing to countries as quote-unquote democratic, even when there's massive paramilitary abuse of opposition parties, when people are shot for joining in a third party, as is in the case in Colombia, when people standing up for their human rights are shot down, but also being the arbiter against popular movements gaining control over a government, as we're seeing in country after country. And so the Ecuadorian indigenous people, who had done so much organizing and built so much of a base of strength, promised that, you know, if things did not change, that they would be back to Quito and they would be back in force in this kind of uprising all across the country, nonviolently occupying streets and roads and shutting down transport between parts of the country, and also organizing local alternative governments all across the country, that where people would come together in assemblies and be able to say what it was that they wanted from their government, and what it was that they wanted in terms of their development and their economy. And, you know, that's a very different model than the, you know, oil-based, timber-based, agro-export-based model that's imposed by the International Monetary Fund.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds totally fantastic that for people to come together in community and all over the country, people who often can't even read or write, and come together with these ideas in a democratic fashion. That's what we're supposed to want. What's what we're supposed to be for in the United States? But yet again, just yesterday I did an interview about the war in Colombia that's against the people, pretty much. It's killing a lot. There's a lot of violence in Colombia, and it's also spilling over into Ecuador. I guess that's partly why the United States wants this base. That's part of the issues here about,
It's very important that you bring that up, because one of the major issues in Ecuador and one of the major issues that's shaping up all across Latin America is this United States plan for Colombia that's called Plan Colombia, which is in part a militarization plan. It's a way of shipping down $1.3 billion in arms and training and military helicopters and the like to the Ecuadorian military. But it's also a plan that relies on an IMF structural adjustment plan and a plan that envisions a certain type of economic development for Ecuador. For Colombia. And what the people of Colombia have said, and what the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia has said, is that there's no place for indigenous peoples in Plan Colombia. And the UBA, who have been resisting Occidental Petroleum, see Plan Colombia as just arming those people who threaten to push them out, who threaten to terrorize them for their resistance, arming the paramilitaries, arming the military, which has been involved in displacing them repeatedly, and also putting up a green light for more companies like Occidental Petroleum to come in. So the UBA have said of Plan Colombia, this is a death sentence for us. And the indigenous peoples of Ecuador have been listening to that. Last June, there was the National Confederation, or the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, staged a one-day takeover of the Occidental Petroleum offices in Quito, Ecuador, in solidarity with the UBA. And once again, in this national uprising, they made as their central, two of their central demands, points in solidarity with the people of Colombia. And those points were that the Manta military base, which is the site of the largest U.S. contingent of military placed abroad in Latin America at this point, and which is the key base or a key base for supporting the regional militarization that's brought about in Plan Colombia, that base right now is being treated in part territory that's effectively U.S. sovereign territory, territory where the United States government has the veto for what goes on in it. And so one of the demands of the indigenous movement was the resumption of national sovereignty over the Manta military base. And the second of the Colombia-related demands was that the government publicly come out against the regionalization of Plan Colombia. Now we've gotten to talk about a number of what the demands are, I should point out that on Wednesday afternoon, there were negotiations between the government and the indigenous leaders, and those negotiations were at first between the vice president of each, because the president would not deign to meet with the indigenous peoples, but they resulted in a groundbreaking accord, which calls for the reduction of the prices of fuel, the availability of public transport all across the country at half fare to the elderly, to students, and to youth, that calls for additional funding for government agencies that fund local government and local visions and as far as health development and as far as educational development, that all across their demands, they were largely being met. And what was met on the Plan Colombia issue was a government renunciation of Plan Colombia. We are still waiting to see, and we are very eager to see, what does this victory translate into for the people of Colombia, for the Manta military base, and for the militarization of the region. But I should add that it's just one more example of how opposition to Plan Colombia is growing. We've had statements from the Mexican government saying that they're lukewarm about it, and that the critics of it need to be listened to. We've had a very harsh critique coming out of the European Parliament, representing all of Western Europe, which rejected Plan Colombia as it's currently put out, and you know, oppose the militarization of Ecuador, or of Colombia. And we've also had statements by 60 of the leading civil society organizations in Colombia, including the National Indigenous Confederation, the National Workers Confederation, you know, on and on and on, for these national level groups that come together, have come together and said, we reject Plan Colombia. And so it's clear that Plan Colombia and the structural adjustment plan in Ecuador and the all these oil developments, they are the product of the United States government, of U.S. corporations, and of very small national elites. But they're, it's very, very obvious that they're not the product of the broad desires of the people of these countries.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what structural adjustment is, because I don't know, practically every interview I do, it comes back down to the International Monetary Fund and this in structural adjustment, but I don't know that the average person really understands what it is. Maybe some do, some don't.
Sure. So around the early 1980s, a lot of southern countries, countries in the global south, had accumulated fairly substantial debts. And there are two real reasons for that. One is that they were often saddled with colonial debt. So even many countries had to take on the price of repressing the movements that brought them independence as part of their national debt. And also because they had to respect the rights of northern corporations to continue having access to their resources until, say, the mid-1970s, when some of those resources were brought back under national control. And thirdly, because in the 1970s, there was a lot of cash floating around in the international economy, and a lot of governments, many of them undemocratic, were loaned a lot of money. They purchased weapons with them. They filled out, in Latin America, they filled out the power of a lot of repressive military regimes up and down the continent. And they also went into the pockets of the very elite. But by the 1980s, international bankers were no longer as willing to subsidize this, and there was something called the debt crisis was born. And this was a crisis simultaneously for the people who are depending on some of these disbursements and those people who are benefiting from any of the projects that were being funded by them. But also, and the reason it became called a debt crisis, it was a crisis for international bankers because there was no way they could get paid back. Mm-hmm. And what the World Bank and the IMF led was an effort to pay them back anyway, like to reward their irresponsibility, to reward their giving this money to military regimes, to reward their giving this money to corrupt elites, by saying, you're going to get every last penny of it back, and we are going to alter the economies of all these countries in order to make sure that you do. And so, and most of those alterations are based on the idea that they would work in one country at a time, but they're being applied to the majority of the planet, to over 4 billion people living under structural adjustment plans. So people have their currencies devalued so that everything is cheaper in their country, and ideally it would sell more to the rest of the world, except for everyone else's currency is devalued too. Or new areas are opened up to foreign investment, which is supposed to generate new development, but the foreign investment of choice has not been national industries that employ a lot of people. It has been the expansion of extractive industries like timber and the oil industry. And in particular, the oil industry in the 10 years from 1988 to 1998 got new leases to extract and explore for oil and gas in an area the size of the United States and Europe combined. So it was a huge new area of corporate colonization that was a part of the structural adjustment plans.
So the United States facilitated the corporations getting this permission to drill oil, you're saying?
Right. So the United States was the leading player in the IMF and the World Bank. The votes are assigned according to the number of dollars that your country has, and the United States led that process. And the United States then leaned on country by country in its international policies, so that we've been able to trace, for instance, that there are dealings between U.S. government officials and foreign government officials saying, you need to let this company go in, you need to let this company stay in. We've seen it around Occidental Petroleum, both around the case of the UWA, but also in Bangladesh, where they caused a catastrophic fire. And the U.S. government said you can't kick them out of your country just because they've caused a national disaster, just because they've cut off half of your country from rail service because of a massive explosion. You need to keep this company in your country. And so it's been a conscious promotion that our government is not acting in our interests, but it's acting in the interests of U.S. corporations.
Yeah. And that oil has really, I mean, we're also dependent on oil and has really horrible effects on people. And to, I mean, I think of the people wading in the oil and washing in the oil and all the animals so that people don't have anything to eat. The animals suffer. It's really, really horrendous. And it's important that people be aware that this is the kind of at the ground level, I guess is what they call it, in terms of where we get our oil and in terms of the politics and our money supporting really the repression of people who stand up against it. That's what you're saying. I know what I was going to say. And that is in all the years I've been doing interviews in international matters, the IMF and the World Bank is behind it every single time. And every single time, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So thank you for explaining that, Carwell. And we don't have too much time left, and we want to be able to give the contact number for Project Underground. So get your pencils ready to do that. And maybe you would want to say what you want to say in closing, including what we might do about being support to the people of Latin America.
So my last comment is that in the United States, the country that uses the most oil, which is Ecuador's primary export, and the country that's the source of many of the corporations that are involved here, we have an ecological debt that we owe to the people of Ecuador for the environmental damage that's been caused in the service of our privilege. And so I hope that people will call us up at Project Underground. We're at 510-705-8981. We're on the web at www.moles.org, M-O-L-E-S.org. And I hope that people will join us in holding these corporations accountable, in particular holding corporations like Texaco, which extracted billions of dollars and owes the Ecuadorian people billions of dollars in environmental and social damage. And we're working on a campaign right now that's focusing on Chevron soon to merge with Texaco for its role in structural racism around the world. And we hope that a lot of people will get involved in that. And we'll also get involved in efforts to challenge the grip that oil companies, this kind of institutional corporate power and institutional racism that are playing out against the indigenous peoples of Ecuador and the indigenous peoples of Colombia, and playing out all across this country, that we believe that we can build a movement to challenge all of this, and that both corporation by corporation and by together challenging these systems of power, we can bring justice.
So Project Underground in Berkeley, California. What's the webpage?
www.moles.org.
That was Sue Supriano speaking with Carwell James of Project Underground in early February.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.